you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Donald Jeffries back on the show. Donald, of course, is an author. He is the author of Hidden History. And also, where's my list here? Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics. I think that was published back in 2014, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. And, of course, more recently, you had Survival of the Richest, how the corruption of the marketplace and the disparity of wealth created the greatest conspiracy of all. And you are working on Hidden History 2, pre-1963 corruption, conspiracies, and cover-ups, which is in the hands of your publisher as we speak, correct?
That's right.
Okay. So we'll see how long that takes. Okay. So Well, tonight, of course, you penned an article that I came across. Not a very long piece, but you covered a lot of ground, so I thought it warranted a discussion we could expand upon and perhaps elaborate. It's titled Mainstream News is Fake News. So, this piece of yours, tell our audience about it.
Well, I'm just amazed, I guess, when I read a lot of liberals, especially who trust in, especially the JFK assassination research community, which I've been a member of for a long time, and it's just amazing to me that the same people they know have been lying to them about the JFK assassination, the MLK assassination, and the RFK assassination for decades, that they will accept them as telling the truth about Trump, and of course the whole Russian collusion theory is just. Drives me bonkers. These are the same people that wanted to have detente with Russia when they were the Soviet Union and taking over half the world. And now that they're trying to, crawl out of that mess, they appear to have some good things going on compared to what we see here in some instances. Suddenly we're willing to believe and that they somehow interfered in our election as if we don't have enough homegrown electoral fraud, as I showed in Hidden History. A lot of this, people that have read Hidden History realize that if there is a main theme of the book, it's about how bad the mainstream media is, because there wouldn't have been a need for a book like mine or other books that are the same kind of genre if we just had real investigative reporting and they ever did any kind of investigation of any of these big events instead of just passing on the official government pronouncements without questioning them.
Yeah, you make that point where basically if they've just been doing their job, you wouldn't you wouldn't have been able to write your book because there'd be no use for it. But because the Fourth Estate actually was a check on governmental corruption and power, there'd be no reason for independent journalists and researchers to dig these things up and engage in conspiracy research. You know, you touch on it here. These various, official narratives throughout history, they're just, if you just scratch the surface, are absurd. And it's obvious that the institutions that rely on for information with the media, even universities, right? If they were just in any way independent, we'd get a clearer picture of what's really going on, and we don't,
Right. Yeah, and that's the problem. We have the universities at that level. They pretty much just pass on the same kind of pablum. And we see in the I go into this a little bit more in Hidden History, too. When that's published, readers will be able to see that. But I really take what I call the court historians to task, because it's kind of a triumvirate there between the establishment, so-called investigative reporters who don't do any investigation, and the professional historians who are usually just enamored with their own reputations. A lot of them are tenured professors and so forth, and they really know so little about the history they're talking about. It's just astonishing to me. I remember not that long ago on C-SPAN, they had a series on assassinations, and I just could not believe this blowhard guy, I think it was from Georgetown, I don't remember his name, but was talking about all the assassinations, and knowing, I've delved into them, obviously, quite a bit over the years, and I just was amazed. It was just one piece of disinformation after another, and there was nobody there to correct him. There was no other side to debate it, and everyone in the audience, apparently no one there was awake enough to know the real facts behind this. I mean, this guy was recommending Bugliosi's book, I think, on the JFK assassination. So that's what he knew about that. And so I'm just sitting there saying, and of course I want to, yell at the TV screen. And unfortunately, people like me don't have a forum like that. So all we can do is talk on shows like this and write books about it. But it's just distressing because, to not know, Thomas Jefferson a long time ago said that, those that in his day and time, even the press wasn't honest, but he talked about how the citizens who didn't read, of course, there were a lot of illiterate people back then who didn't read the newspapers, knew more about what was actually going on than the people who did. And I think that's the way it is today. I mean, people who watch television news, the few people left who read the major newspapers and the major news magazines, who listen to the late night comedy routines on the talk shows, who are, kind of pass on the pablum about whatever latest joke about Trump or whatever they're going to tell. I think people like that know less about what's really going on than someone who's, deep in Appalachia or somewhere, who's really far removed from everything and doesn't really know about any of the news. Because sometimes I think disinformation is worse than having not any information. And was Thomas Jefferson thought so, and I think it still holds true today.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about, of course, the basic forensics and what we know of the JFK assassination, and also some of the absurdity of the official narrative of 9/11. Yet the mainstream media promotes those narratives as if there's no legitimate or rational or reasonable reason to question those narratives. And there's no evidence to cite, countervailing evidence or anything, and it's just the fevered thinking of conspiracy theorists. Which, of course, as you, I think that whole thing came out of the CIA, the whole meme, conspiracy theory.
Right.
Yeah. To discredit those who are who are exposing the problems with the Warren Report in regards to the Kennedy JFK assassination.
Yeah, we can read that the 1967 memo from the CIA, and it's a directive, and if the mainstream media didn't actually follow that directive as if they'd been issued it themselves, they did a perfect job of just coincidentally following it, because they have followed everything there. And it's just a classic case of kill the messenger. Now they kind of kill us with, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, you're a tinfoil hat wearer, whatever. And they don't have any evidence. So they really can't. That's why, you can't have like that guy from Georgetown that's on C-SPAN or any other discussion. I mean, there's never, ever been a debate about 9/11 on any major television network. They just won't let people on. And it's because they understand that if they let someone like myself on there talking with any of the official apologists, if they gave us equal time, the public would see exactly how absurd the official story is there, and how all these official stories are built on nothing, as Richard Schweiker once described the Warren Report as a house of cards. And all these official stories are house of cards. They're the least little bit of investigation, and they come crumbling down. But the problem is, the only people doing the investigating are citizen journalists. They're not any so-called professional journalists, because they do absolutely no investigation whatsoever. All they do is pass on what the authorities say, whatever government agency is so-called investigating. They're not doing an investigation, but whatever their pronouncements are, they pass them on, and they don't question anything about the, again, in Hidden History, people can see how these narratives change, especially early on. Essential facts about them change, and these reporters just, they don't blink. You know, you just say, you just talked about, for instance, Sandy Hook incident, as recent as that, where, early on it was that the guy, Adam Lanza, had killed his father, and then or his brother. I think it was father. I can't remember. He was killed somebody else. I think it was his father. And then he killed his mother in the school, because his mother was a kindergarten teacher there. Well, and then a local reporter here actually did an interview with the school nurse, which is a detailed interview about how wonderful a person his mother was, and she was a beloved kindergarten teacher there. Everybody there loved her, and how they remembered Adam as a small kid coming into school. They never could have thought he would have done this. Well, the next day, suddenly, his mother wasn't a kindergarten teacher there. His mother was killed in her home. The father wasn't killed anywhere, even though reports were that a dead body was found there. No investigation. Well, what happened to all that? And I actually contacted that local reporter who did the interview with the nurse. And I said, how did she possibly give an interview like that? I said nothing about conspiracy, but I guess she read through the lines, and I just said, didn't you wonder about how she could possibly make a mistake like that? And she said, well, yeah, I did wonder, but there was no conspiracy. So, and she's a very nice person. What little I know of her, she's a typical soccer mom type of journalist, so-called, but that's the level that's out there. They're trained, as Harold Weisberg told me, that when I met him back in the early 80s, the dean of the JFK assassination critics, he said it was really sadder, the performance of the media in the JFK assassination, because it would have possibly been understandable if they had been given directives from, Conspiracy Central, don't do this. But they didn't even have to be given that, although NBC News did agree early on, as I'm sure you probably know, they agreed within a day or two of the assassination to only televised information that was consonant, as they called it, consonant with the FBI report and the assassination. In other words, they weren't going to talk about anything that didn't fit the official narrative. So that one network agreed in writing. So I don't know who told them to agree to it, but they just willingly did. They probably did in those days, that if they thought it was their patriotic duty, because I guess it was unthinkable to most people that, the government would lie about the murder of a president. But we see it down to this day, like something is even something like Sandy Hook, where you can see something like that. And that, if I bring that up, if I write about that, oh my God, you don't respect those kids. That's terrible. You must want. I'm just questioning. That's not a theory, but that's a legitimate question. How do you conduct an interview with a school nurse where they talk about a woman working there for a long time as a beloved teacher? You can't probably make that's an innocent mistake. And that happens, maybe not to that extent, but that happens throughout a lot of these instances where, for instance, in the Vince Foster murder, where there's a Secret Service memo that talks about finding his body in his car. That contradicts every aspect of the crime scene, because we were told his body was found on the ground in Fort Marcy Park. So, again, that cries out for a real Woodward and Bernstein, for a deep throat, but you never see them. You never see any kind of investigation other than very small, in the old days, very small newspapers like the Spotlight or alternative papers like that, and nowadays websites and podcasts like this and conspiracy forums. And that's the only place you find it. It's really sad, and that's why I say mainstream news is basically, until they prove otherwise on any issue, they're entirely fake, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a reasonable suspicion. At least that's a good default position to take now, especially on bigger stories, but even on little stuff, because a lot of that it's propaganda, psychological warfare. Good point regarding Sandy Hook, because that's just not you can't reconcile that that school nurse's account with the official narrative, and nor can you write it off as a mistake, because it's almost like she's reading from another script, which is telling. And I think the reporter's response when she says conspiracy, she's in effect, although she probably didn't read the memo that the CIA wrote back in 1967, she's following it, because you're smearing anyone who's suspicious of some sort of cover-up or a fake event as being a conspiracy, although those conspiracies are well documented throughout history. I think also in San Diego, the local newspaper interviewed the principal, who's supposedly also was the second victim, but they supposedly interviewed her after the shooting event.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there are tons of questions. That's exactly right. Dawn Hawk, I can't remember her name.
Hawkspring or something?
But yeah, Celia Hawkspring, that's it, right, yeah. But, again, okay, maybe it's possible here. There, of course, people are human. Reporters are human. News outlets are human. So we expect it, and that's what typically they say. Well, nothing's perfect. People make mistakes. Oh, I understand that, of course. But these kinds of mistakes happen over and over again. And when they're about things big enough as a mother working at the school and the teacher in great detail about how beloved she is. Something like that's not a mistake. Or if Vince Foster's body being found in a car as opposed to on the ground. I mean, that's a huge essential part of the crime scene. Where was the body found? So I think when you see mistakes like that, it's just or go back to the JFK assassination. The rifle supposedly found on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building was found by two officers Boone and Weitzman. They both signed sworn affidavits that it was a German Mauser. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we were later told it was an Italian Carcano. And as Mark Lane told them, the Warren Commission, when he testified before them, he held the rifle up and he said, "Look, gentlemen, I'm not an arms expert, but I can tell you right here, it's not a German Mauser because it clearly is stamped on the barrel, made in Italy." Mm-hmm. So you can't make those kinds of mistakes. And those are, again, essential things that a real investigation would have said, and actually in a real courtroom. I point out many times on JFK forums that if Oswald had been tried, had lived and stood trial in an honest court, which he probably wouldn't have, because that seldom happens. But if he had, let's theoretically say, and if he had adequate legal representation, which that probably wouldn't happen either, judging by the past. But if he had at any, a good, even an honest court-appointed attorney, the first thing they would have done was say, "Well, look at this, this so-called evidence," and they would have started with the weapon. And they would have said, "Wait a minute, the only official evidence we have, a chain of possession for this, where it was found. It was found on this. It just suddenly appeared in the record, but there's no legal record of it because the affidavit signed by two different officers that found the weapon on the sixth floor swore it was a completely different weapon." So I would have said, "Your Honor, I'm sorry, this is inadmissible." And if it was an honest judge, they would have to they couldn't enter that weapon into the record because there was no legal chain of possession for it. It just appeared out of nowhere. Oh, they both were mistaken. Like, everybody was mistaken, is mistaken in all these cases in so many significant ways, and mistaken in all the exact same ways. Like the JFK assassination, we saw 57 witnesses, I think my friend Vince Palorama originally tabulated as, talked about the motorcade stopping. And of course, we don't see that in any of the film record, but did they all really, all unconnected to each other? Did they all really just come up with that curious observation? Because it's not like the Warren Commission counsels were asking them pertinent questions. They weren't saying, "Did you see the motorcade stopper?" I mean, they all brought this up on their own, 57 different witnesses. Obviously, the motorcade stopped. When all the doctors at Parkland Hospital and the nurses, every one of them described a huge blowout, a huge hole in the back of JFK's head. Yet we look at the autopsy photos and pictures and x-rays that are in the record. It shows an intact back of the head. So, again, were they all mistaken like that? Medical professionals? I don't believe it. But, again, we don't have any – there are no journalists out there to do – the only reason the public out there knows about this is because people like Mark Lane and Harold Weisberg early on and people like you and I are to this day still trying to make them aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, something as perhaps telling as a Zapruder film, of course, was sequestered by none other than C.D. Jackson of Time Life, and I think some suggestion is that itself was doctored to cover some things up.
Yeah.
You know, and we all know that Jackie climbed onto the hood of the back of the car to collect the, the brain matter of her husband. Right. So, I mean.
Right. And what kind of a media? I mean, at that time, Life magazine was the biggest magazine in the world, most important magazine in the world. What kind of media outfit buys and pays a huge sum? Still not really sure the exact sum they paid the Zapruder family early on. Later, of course, the Zapruder's family made a lot more money out of it. But early on, they basically paid the film and then they suppressed it. They didn't show it. Now, why? You know, what kind of course? Then the excuse then was that, and we were in a much more innocent time. I mean, now we're so jaded, and we look at that, and whether the film is real or not, it doesn't have any impact on us. I mean, it did the first time I saw it, but again, that was probably 1974, 75. So, it was shown officially at 75 on by Geraldo Rivera of all people on Good Night America, but thanks to Robert Groden and Dick Gregory. But we've become so jaded this, it doesn't have the impact. But again, why would a media outlet do that? And the same thing happened with I can't remember who bought the Knicks film, but they suppressed that too. And both films were altered. And in a real investigative journalistic environment, especially with all the other questions being raised early on, even, but almost all of those questions were raised in Europe, as Mark Lane talked about for years. You know, he eventually got Rush to Judgment published, and it was a bestseller, a sensational bestseller, but he couldn't even write it about the assassination early on in this country. You know, his friends, and he had lots of contacts in the journalistic world in New York and so forth, and they would tell him, no, this will never be published here. You can't publish it. So he had to go over to Europe and have it published. And, you know, that's a disgrace. That really is a disgrace, but that's, you know, that was, and I think there's a lot of that, even assuming that these are honorable people that are in the journalistic community. Even if you assume all of them have great morals and great motives and principles, I think there's a pride factor, especially with the people that are remaining from that era, which aren't very many, but the Hugh Ainsworth types that are still around. They're just digging their feet in further because they're just not going to admit that they made, even if it was honest errors and they were just parroting, it was normalcy bias, which is, I think a lot of this can be attributed to normalcy bias, is that people don't want that, they don't want to see that incredible corruption out there. No. There has to be an Occam's razor. You know, there has to be an innocent explanation for this. Let's come up with something logical. Well, you know, logical to them is something that can be explained simplistically, you know, Hollywood style or something.
like a magic bullet?
Yeah, exactly. And that doesn't compute to them because, oh, a bullet can't zig and zag. Well, you know, you look at the holes. You look at the bullet holes. Yeah. You look at the alleged point of impact. You look at the where it came from. I mean, just, you know, the Oliver Stone, very dramatically before that even, but 1991, everyone remembers, back into the left,
yeah,
you know, showing how the bullet holes lined up, because and thank goodness he did that, because it's there for anyone to see. And
Dorothy Kilgallen was asking questions, right, the journalist?
Yeah, well, and that seems to be what happens to the few journalists, or, you know, that happened. Yeah, exactly. She was she asked too many questions, apparently, and that's and I think there's been a new book that came out about her recently, about her death. And but again, it's any of these things, if they admitted that Dorothy Kilgallen was murdered by anyone, well, then they have to peel back that layer a little bit. Well, who would have a motive to murder? I don't think she was upsetting the other panel members of What's My Line. I don't think Bennett Cerf knocked her off. You know, so again, they have to look at, okay, what else was she looking into? She was, okay, she supposedly had the only private interview with Jack Ruby, you know, and, so again, it's any of these things. That's why I try to concentrate on so many different issues, and why I've talked about Sandy Hook or even things like that more recently, is because any of these things, the Seth Meyers, you know, murder last year, even any of these things, if they're exposed and proven, that's why Julian Assange is so dangerous.
Media. Seth Rich, not Seth Meyers.
I'm sorry, Seth Meyers. Seth Meyers. That's the guy on television.
He's a funny guy.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think anybody's going to knock him off. He's the part.
He's no trouble to anybody.
No, he's He's doing exactly what they want. But so Seth's rich, but somebody like something like that, and Julian Assange has obviously leaked a lot about the Seth Rich thing. But there's a guy, there's a real journalist, Julian Assange, but and he's living abroad in fear, and lots of people think he's a traitor. And of course, because he's leaked things about the Democrats, now the people that used to like him and be sympathetic to him back when he leaked things during the Bush administration, now they hate him. And,
yeah,
and,
changes him. Now Republicans are. Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, it's like,
and now they like him. Yeah. And now, you know, I guess he's colluding with the Russians. But
he's a traitor. He's not even an American citizen.
He's a traitor. Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it just again, it's astonishing. And I kind of understand. I guess. I mean, look what happened to Edward Snowden. Look what happened to Bradley Chelsea Manning. Mm-hmm. The people, the whistleblowers that are out there, the high profile people that do the jobs that Bradley Manning and. Snowden did the things that, you know, the journalists at the New York Times and the Washington Post and ABC and CBS and NBC wouldn't do. So and they exposed danger to themselves. And obviously that Manning is, you know, I guess still in prison. It's ridiculous to be in prison for them. I mean, I'm not sure how to refer to that person, but whoever he or she is had great courage to do that and tremendously unjust sentence that they're serving at this point, because all Manning did was reveal the atrocious behavior of our armed forces, and we all ought to be embarrassed about it instead of, again, digging our heels in and saying, USA, USA. And Snowden, obviously, Oliver Stone made another great movie about him last year, but all he did was reveal that our own government was spying on us, and yet politicians from Donald Trump to Hillary Clinton, again, both sides of the spectrum, seem to think he's a traitor. And I don't understand that. And Julian Assange, like I said, to me, all he's doing is he's exposing things about our leaders that we should have a right to know. And we would know if we had real Woodwards and Bernsteins out there, they would be doing this kind of stuff. Because, I mean, again, if I had a newspaper staff full of conspiracy theorists and the resources that these people have, I can't imagine the kind of stories we could break. But although, you know, I guess our staff might be in great danger all the time. It'd be worse than, I guess, working in a, you know, a very high crime area as a police officer. But so, you have to understand, OK, this is hazardous duty. But eventually, I think, and that's what I think, I really think our leaders would have to, they'd have to roll back on the corruption a little bit if it started being exposed, because that's the only thing that allows this stuff to continue all the time, is because no sunshine. You know, we need a huge sunshine law on everything. Sunshine is the best disinfectant, and it's not being shown on any of these issues except in the corners of the internet like we are right now, or in books like mine and other writers that write about that. And we really need people with huge resources. We need, like, if a renegade billionaire that was honest, you know, started their own television network and really, you know, to millions of people started hearing these things. And, you know, so many people will not believe it if it's on YouTube, but the same information, the exact same thing, they'll believe if it pops up on a television network still. So we just had something like that, an honest Ted Turner type, someone, let's say Ted Turner was honest and wanted to expose the corruption. Somebody had those kind of resources. Man, that would be more powerful than having 100 new honest Congress people in Congress.
Yeah, I think the biggest obstacle to that is there's no practical way one to become a billionaire and be honest. So,
exactly.
you're part of the system. Your book, you know, you didn't build that. Might cover shine some.
Yeah.
Explain how the system works. I mean,
they became Survival of the Richest. Yeah, the one that was originally called You Didn't Build That, but now it's Survival of the Richest.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I know.
Original title, yeah. Survival of the Richest.
You did. I gave you a couple interviews, and you were one of them before it was published. Yeah. They ended up changing the title. But the premise is the same.
All the billionaires and the high, you know, the celebrity journalists, they cavort at Bohemian Grove, and you mentioned that Bilderberg and these things, and this is how they coordinate. Yeah. The CFR, a lot of these journalists are members of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is sort of these imperial think tanks, and they coordinate policy, governmental corporate policy, and it's kind of like a secret society, but way it works is they'll coordinate with government officials, journalists, media, even Hollywood to promote certain memes or visions or interpretations of realities that promote their corporate policy, which is
when I was writing Survival of the Richest, I wrote to the Council of Foreign Relations several times because I looked at their membership list, and it just amazes even me. I mean, Angelina Jolie is a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, and I asked them several times, what I don't understand. The name implies that you have something to do with foreign policy. So what does an actress and there are other celebrities like that have been and continue to be that come from the entertainment world, journalistic world, that have presumably no impact on foreign policy at all? I said, what are the qualifications here? I'm interested in the process here. How did you become a member? And all they did was send me a link to apply for membership. And I said, well, I don't think the Council of Foreign Relations is going to accept me as a member. But so I didn't get an answer out of it. And that chapter actually ended up, I don't think it ended up in the book, but I have it online. I've published some chapters about that kind of stuff that were excerpted from the book on my blog. But that's the kind of thing that you just sit there and scratch your head, and that makes you go way down the rabbit hole, because you think, okay, in what world would you think of asking an actress to be a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, whatever that is? And that's why, and they've been high-profile journalists forever have been members of the council, and it's usually different few at a time, but there's never been, as far as I know, the only piece about the Council of Foreign Relations that ever appeared in the mainstream media, I think I have the exact reference in the chapter that was deleted from the book that's on the blog, but I think it was back in the 50s, maybe the 60s. The only, and it wasn't really an investigative piece, it was just kind of a story about the Council on Foreign Relations. Other than that, the John Birch Society used to talk about them on the right, and they used to, I used to get their little pamphlets. It didn't belong to them, obviously, but they would send out a list to interested people, like a little pamphlet that showed all the members, and I would always be interested, and I'd show my friends, look at this, can you believe this? They're all members of the same club, and this was back in the 80s, and they would just kind of roll their eyes, because again, it was people just, I don't know what it takes to wake people up, but the idea that these high-profile journalists would be members of this, and of course the Bilderberg meetings that they go to every year, and for decades they swore, that's crazy, it doesn't happen. Well, then the spotlight initially, and then under James Tucker, the late, great James Tucker, started infiltrating their meetings every year, and later he worked with Alex Jones, or not worked with him, but he would come on Alex Jones back when Alex Jones was still doing good work. He jumped on the Trump into the Trump administration unofficially, apparently, but Jim Tucker would still report on that, and they'd talk about it every year, and they'd show how these journalists show up there, and they're sworn to secrecy. I mean, this is just, can anyone imagine a more conspiratorial thing than royalty, the top heads of corporations from all over the world showing up with American bigwigs, bankers, entertainers, showing up, and journalists, of course, in secret, top secret locations, top security, every year at some kind of secluded location, to the absolute silence of the mainstream media. And this is the same media that will kill each other over trying to get a photograph of some celebrity wedding. So what does that tell you about the media? And we talked about Bohemian Grove. It's the same kind of thing where, what are our all-male leaders? What are they doing going up in the woods in Northern California every July for a couple weeks, so no women allowed?
Well, they're just drinking beer. They're just drinking beer and peeing in the woods.
Yeah, that's right. They do like to pee in Mr. Redwoods, as Bill Clinton said. But I mean, then Alex Jones sneaks in there. Again, the greatest thing he's ever done. He snuck in. He filmed. I mean, they laughed, scoffed at the idea of the owl. Well, he filmed the 40-foot owl. It's there.
Yeah, I think the voice was Henry Kissinger or something. Walter Cronkite. Yeah, it works.
Henry Kissinger, I think, was photographed in drag there.
Okay,
apparently committing a sex act. I've never seen the photograph, but that's what I heard.
He probably was in LSD again, so.
Yeah. But so
well,
again,
I saw there's a picture. People who scoff at these things like Bilderberg the media takes more interest in the NFL draft than do at Bilderberg. But Bohemian Grove, I just saw a picture. This is from 1968, and you have these businessmen, I guess the captains of the industry at the time, and next to him is Governor Ronald Reagan, and soon to be President Richard Nixon, and all these business leaders. Are you going to tell me that what they're talking about doesn't have some sort of public implications? Yeah. Or the public has no interest in what conversations might be going on at this place?
Exactly, right. I think it was Herbert Hoover. I think I had that in the Hidden History too. I'll have more about that. But I believe he admitted that he found out he was being he was a Republican nominee in 1928, I guess it was, when he was at Bohemian Grove. So I mean, these things have happened for a long time, and the idea that these important movers and shakers get together just to kind of blow off steam, I mean, you know, I find it preposterous. And when you throw in the occult resonance, which of course these occult connections were everywhere, but if you've seen that video, I urge anyone to watch it online. Inside Bohemian Grove is Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove, I think it is, but it's everywhere online. And the video is not the greatest, but again, he was filming from a long way. The sound's pretty good, but you can tell what's going on. You can see the giant owl. You can see the men in these creepy occult robes. You can hear the occult chanting and the kind of the ominous music. And it's very disturbing to think that our leaders, and I would guarantee you that almost all of them would probably claim they're upstanding Christians and Jews, are attending these kind of occult ceremonies that just fly in the face of that. And to me, as a person of principle, if I was even invited to something like that, I think I'd leave after 5 minutes, because I would say, you know, what the cremation of care ceremony? What does that mean? And the owl, I know that's the god of Moloch, who's the god of child sacrifice in the Old Testament. And it's supposedly a mock human sacrifice. And then, of course, as I wrote in Hidden History, we know how one of the kids involved in the Franklin cover-up scandal out in Nebraska talked about attending. He described the cremation of care ceremony to a T long before anyone snuck inside of it and before anybody knew what went on in Bohemian Grove. And he claimed a real child sacrifice took place.
Yeah, that was
That
was Paul Benacci, I think.
Right, Paul Bonacci, exactly. Yeah. Who somehow I think survived. Some of the others were killed, but he somehow I think still alive, hopefully. But yeah, and it's just. But again, when you talk about these things, when you go that far down the rabbit hole, normalcy bias kicks in, and the average person doesn't want to hear it. They kind of run screaming if you talk about it too much, because it upsets. They want to have a positive view. We all want to feel optimistic, and we'd like to all think positively, but. You know, it's impossible to talk about these things without mentioning the reality and where they go. And of course, that's what we saw, I think, with Pizzagate, you know, and all that. When Julian Assange leaked all those disturbing emails with all the incredible references to pizza and pasta, and apparently how they're code words in the underground for girls and boys, little girls and little boys. And when you saw how many times they were mentioned, you can't help but think they're code for something. Because it's just unnatural for someone to say, you know, the pizza-related map and all that. I mean, I wrote an article on my blog about that, too. All this crazy stuff. And I get in arguments even with some conspiracy theorists. And, you know, Alex Jones made that really, I thought, was really pathetic apology to the guy that owned Pizza Place.
James Alifanis.
James Alifanis. Yeah, comic pizza.
49th most powerful person in D.C.
Yeah. And it just, I don't know. I mean, and the guy on YouTube captured this guy, Alifanis, threatening him. So, I mean, I don't understand. Nobody's accusing anybody of anything, but as I've argued with people about is look at the Instagram photos that were published online, and they're disturbing. A little girl being duct taped to a table and just, you know, just really creepy statements about, you know, a rum kill room, hashtag kill room, I think somebody wrote just in it. And just, you know, I don't know what's going on there, but that's the kind of stuff. When I know about the Franklin cover-up and the McMartin preschool scandal and the Promise Keepers, all these people that I wrote about, Keepers, I think it was.
The Finders, you mean?
The Finders, I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah, Promise Keepers, that's something else. Sorry for that. I apologize to them. Yeah, I wrote about all that in Hidden History, and other people have written about it, and it's there. I mean, there's clearly some kind of strange and perverted predilection amongst our leaders for these sexual.
Well, the Speaker of the House, former Speaker of the House, Denny Hastert, was exposed as a pedophile and a predator. Exactly. And I make the point he didn't become Speaker of the House despite the fact he's a pedophile. He became Speaker of the House because he was a pedophile.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think that's what it is.
It's all about a control file.
Yeah, I think, you know, naturally there's not that many pedophiles among the public, hopefully, but I don't think to have so many that seem to be in areas of public prominence, you can't help but go to the conspiracy angle and think, well, okay, they're selected because they're blackmailable, and if they go out of line, okay, we'll reveal this about you. I mean, you know, how many, you know, vehemently anti-gay Republicans are later, you learn they're gay. I mean, it happens all the time. It's like, yeah. I almost, when I hear somebody ranting and raving about gays, I just assume, well, they're gay. I mean, that's because that always, I mean, why would that be? But I just don't think coincidentally it could be. And I just think that, again, if we had some kind of, somebody in the mainstream media, if you had 60 Minutes or, you know, 2020 or those kind of shows in there, I don't even know what's on anymore. I don't watch network television news. I literally can't stand it for even a minute. It's just torture watching bad. And it's such an elementary level.
Yeah, the special on the Nebraska case was actually supposed to air and it was shut down. It was even listed in
Conspiracy of Silence.
Yeah, Conspiracy of Silence. Yes. What was it called again? It's called the Franklin Scandal.
Conspiracy of Silence.
Well, that's kind of funny because
the book's Franklin Scandal.
If you look at the reason why it's called the Franklin Scandal is because of the Franklin Credit Union, which was run by this guy Lawrence King, who was this up and coming black Republican.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting because with that case, you get a possible intersection of human trafficking, organized crime, drug running, money laundering, cocaine, and the Contras. And this is one of the reasons why.
Yeah.
Because if there was someone wanted to investigate the child trafficking angle, they couldn't go too far because they open up a can of worms with this abuse of the savings and loans and banks that was carried out by organized crime and intelligence agencies in the 1970s and 80s to fund black ops. And that's a whole can of worms. And that's that's the embezzlement charge he went away on. But even the Washington Times, in I think it was in June of 1989, did an article. It was supposed to be a series of articles about the call boy ring.
Yes.
And this was Craig Spence's operation being operated.
Right.
He had a mansion that was wired for audiovisual. You know, he claims by an intelligence agency. And because that's blackmail, that's a blackmail operation. And we've had recent cases, you know, the guy down in Florida, Trump's friend and Clinton's friend, what's his name? The
Epstein.
The Epstein case.
Epstein. Lolita Island.
Lolita Express and the stuff. And there's another, you know, no one really tells how he became a billionaire. It's kind of strange.
Right.
But his assistant was this guy, this lady rather, Gishelle Maxwell. It's the daughter of this guy Maxwell, who was like a Mossad agent who died mysteriously. Who's a big media mogul at the time. You know.
Yeah, exactly. He certainly was. I think he died in Stern's drowning or something years ago. But Craig Spence, I mean, you talked about him, and he had some. I'm amazed. I don't know what the Washington Times is doing during that brief period of time, but they you know, once in a while you see some events. Investigative reporting. They did some good investigative reporting on this story in the first Bush White House. And this guy had several inflammatory quotes how he wasn't going to go down with the ship. And then he ends up dead. He found his body in a hotel room and he writes this, you know, very dramatic Hollywood-like, you know, statement on the mirror about, you know, you always said don't sacrifice, you're not willing, you don't ask others to sacrifice if you don't sacrifice, God bless America. I mean, just, you know, very, very weird stuff, especially after what he was saying. But as you know, hidden history is full of this kind of thing. So I understand the reluctance of people to talk about it, but there's power in numbers, and the more of us that try to talk about this stuff, because I think you can wake people up, but you just have to get them past their normalcy bias. And it's so important. I said so many people. I mean, I know I've seen people. The same stuff I may have been saying for years, you know, at parties and family gatherings. If someone on television says the same thing, boom, a light bulb goes off in their head. And, you know, suddenly it must be true, you know, because even though more and more people don't get their news from television, still I think the majority do, and especially the majority of what we call the sheeple, the people that are asleep. You know, there's awake people to certain degrees, and there's, although maybe we're egotistical to think we're awake, but, you know, I think we're awake, and there's so many people that are just asleep to the corruption around them, and they're just, their reality is – it's basically let's think positive, and you know, I don't want to go there, and it's J. Edgar Hoover said, of all people, you know, a great conspirator himself, but he, in relation to the communist conspiracy, he said, you know, the great mass of people don't want to confront something this extensive. Mm-hmm. And I think that applies to the public at large now, to the corruption that we have, because it's much more extensive than J. Edgar Hoover could have ever imagined, even about even having our red under every bed, because the corruption is so pervasive and so extensive. I don't know if you saw a video it just broke viral in the last couple of days. I mean, I write a lot about the police state. When we are, you know, we're a burgeoning police state. But I just found that even for this kind of police state that we live in sometimes, there was a teacher in Louisiana that was just – she was just protesting to the school board. There was a meeting for teachers, and she just questioned the huge raise that the school superintendent had given themselves and said, you know, we haven't had raises in years. The teachers, and, you know, you've upped classroom size from 21 to 29 – they had an armed guard that came and escorted her out, threw her down on the ground, put handcuffs on her, and the police took her away. And it's like, this is a teacher. All she did was question the school superintendents giving themselves a raise. And that kind of is one of those areas where it interested me, because so many of my interests and things I write about kind of intersected there. The survival of the richest thing, where here you have on a local level kind of an elitist guy, mm-hmm. you know, taking a huge raise while the underlings are not getting raises, and then when they question it, he uses the authority of the state, you know, to cart her away. And I don't know when the public's going to reach the tipping point in the police thing. Again, I think investigative reporting would help there, but we don't. The only time you ever see these, and you can look online, everybody, you could literally look every day and see new instances of police doing absolutely horrendous things, illegal things, all that are caught on tape, and who knows how many are not caught on tape, but mm-hmm. just the ones that are caught on tape, and there's so little investigative reporting about it, and there's nobody in Congress demanding, you know, hearings on why these officers do these things, and their superiors constantly say they acted appropriately and let them right back on the force to do it again. Mm-hmm. And if we just had a series of articles, again, Woodward and Bernstein that track these things, and you know, some of these officers, I mean, there are people like a female police officer that shot and killed a boy that answered the door. He answered his door, and he had a Nintendo Wii controller in his hand. She shot and killed him because she thought it was a gun. She had and that's awful. And she already had a track record before where she had been transferred out of another jurisdiction because she had shot and killed a woman who was reaching in her purse for, a lighter or something. She thought it was a gun. I mean, a
gypsy cop, they call it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, so, you know,
jurisdiction when they get fired, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, or maybe how, like, you know, the Catholic priest used to – the yeah. church used to sometimes move the priest around, you know, mm-hmm. from parish to parish, that there are whispers about them and then the altar boys. But, you know, so it's – if you just had an investigative media that reported things – because I don't – you know, I post these things on Facebook all the time, stories about them, and they get a little bit of attention. But I can tell most of the people there, even in the conspiracy movement, are just kind of – you know, and you wonder when the public's going to reach a tipping point about so many things. But certainly on that, it's so in your face. But I think on so many of these things, and that's, I think, the problem we run into, too, when we're trying to get people to talk about the media not covering these things, unless it applies to that person's, you know, it affects their personal lives. If they run into the, you know, if the media covers up something about their personal lives. Like I briefly kind of knew a family that was near me in the area. There was a young boy. I haven't written about it. So his name escapes me this minute, but probably 15 years ago or so. And his story was on Unsolved Mysteries, actually. And his body was found, and the authorities claimed he killed himself in his home. And the parents kind of, you know, balked at that. There were a lot of questions about it. And come to find out, he was it was like an undercover agent working on campus for a local police or a law enforcement or something. And the police just acted so inappropriately. And the mother, it broke the mother's heart. It killed her. She died. And the father, I corresponded with him, both of them, a few times, and the father died very young as well. I've tried to track down, apparently no family members left, but that was something local to me. And it was garden variety corruption on a local level. But a family like that, I'm guessing they were just your average run-of-the-mill family. They hadn't experienced any corruption firsthand, but once it impacted their lives, when they knew that the police and the media were lying about their own son's death, something like that, I'm sure that really opened their eyes. And we saw that my friend Linda Hayden Ives, who I'm friends with on Facebook and correspond a lot, she's the mother of one of the boys on the train tracks in Arkansas,
yeah.
Kevin Ives. And she's a wonderful woman. And she told me, I wasn't, the press would paint someone like her as some kind of crazed right-wing a Christian lunatic who hated Bill Clinton. She said, we weren't even political at all. Most people aren't political. They don't even really care that much. They didn't care one way or another about Bill Clinton until their son was found dead on the train tracks and every powerful person in that state lied about it. Then it became personal, and this woman's a real profile in courage that she's still fighting. You're talking about this goes back to the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gone 30 years now. She's still trying to fight for more than 30 years. She's still fighting for justice for her son. I think she's a tremendous profile in courage. But she's a perfect example of what I say. These people, they're caught up in circumstances, but when it hits them, they may not have felt that way. Linda Tripp, who I talked to on the phone in the course of writing Hidden History, very demonized. And again, mm-hmm. I think she was fairly wealthy, and I think she still got some money. She came out of it as a survivor, like most of these people. But she described to me what it was like, to see her, herself lampooned on Saturday Night Live and made fun of mercilessly. And her only crime, again, was being in the wrong place at the wrong time. She worked in the office where this Monica Lewinsky worked. And she said, we all knew about the Clinton body count. They all talked about it at work, and they didn't want Monica to become another party to it. But she wasn't a buddy. Like she said, Monica Lewinsky was my children's age. We weren't buddy-buddy. I just happened to work there, and I was trying to give her advice. But the press, again, instead of investigating it, and they did no investigation at all during the Clinton years, or the Obama years especially, they, instead of doing that, they made fun of Linda Tripp. They demonized her. And here's a person, again, who probably had no I think she said, we voted Democrat, but we weren't really – they weren't conservatives. But what happened there? They ran up to they because the corruption impacted their lives. Obviously, she has a completely different view. I'm sure she has a more jaded and cynical view of the world, as does Linda Ives and lots of other people who've if you don't experience it firsthand, then you don't know. If you're as Gary Webb wrote very eloquently, I quoted his whole statement in Hidden History. But the guy that San Jose Mercury mm-hmm. news reporter. And he had won prizes. He's a typical liberal reporter. But as he said, he wrote this great statement. He said, the system worked great for me. He said, I was going along fine. I thought I was this crackerjack reporter, and I thought I had won these awards and had this great life because of the great work I was doing. He said, no. Little did I know, it's because I had never written about anything important enough for these powers yes. to be and fight back against me. And once they did, his life fell apart. And you see what happened. His marriage fell apart, and he eventually, I believe, was murdered. They claimed he killed himself, but his life was completely destroyed. And again, all because he wrote about the CIA and the running drugs through South America to into the inner cities with crack cocaine. And we can see this time and time again. And it's just the average citizen, if they haven't experienced it, they just kind of, well, that sucks for him. My life is cool. And that's I run into that all the time. I'm doing fine. My 401k made a bunch of money. The stock market's up. So, hey, what do I care? And I think the people need to start caring, because it certainly could affect everyone. And if we don't do something about this massive corruption, the whole system is going to collapse. And then, we're all going to wonder what happened.
Yeah, we won't understand what happened. Good chance your fat 401k is being inflated by narcotics trafficking. So
yeah, exactly.
Wall
sure.
Street is funded by that. There's a interesting because the reason why the press doesn't do its job, and they seem to be anytime a reporter seems to dig something up, their careers are destroyed. Well, there's something called Operation Mockingbird, Long ago, the mainstream press was suborned and completely taken over. It's never really been free. They've always been owned by corporations. If newspapers or large capital investments can be owned by a corporation, has other interests that can do the bidding of that corporation. But there's a great quote. There's a article by Alex Constantine, The Depraved Spies and Moguls of CIA's Operation Mockingbird. And he starts out, who controls the media? Soulless corporations do, of course. Corporations with grinning, double-breasted executives, interlocking directorates, labor squabbles, and flying capital. Dow, General Electric, Coca-Cola, Disney. Newspapers should have the mastheads that mirror the world. The Westinghouse Evening Scimitar, the Atlantic Richfield Intelligencer. It is beginning to dawn on a growing number of armchair ombudsmen that the public print reports news from a parallel universe, one that has never heard of politically motivated assassinations, CIA mafia banking thefts, mind control, death squads, or even federal agencies with secret budgets fattened by cocaine sales, a place overrun by lone gunmen where the CIA and the mafia are usually on their best behavior. In this idyllic land, the most serious infraction an official can commit is the employment of a domestic servant with shutter, no residency status. This unlikely land of enchantment is the creation of Mockingbird.
Well, it's exactly right. We know the public knows that Operation Mockingbird, it existed. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of us think it still existed, but I wrote again a lot about this in Hidden History. But today we can look at someone like Anderson Cooper, mm-hmm. First of all, he crosses over into the world of survival of the richest because he's the son of Gloria Vanderbilt, and he's obviously he came from great wealth, and I don't think he fought his way to the top, but it's acknowledged that the CIA recruited him when he was at college, and that happens to so many of these young journalists. They get recruited when they're in college, and they get in the system, and it's kind of like the mafia. Once you get in, and Oliver Stone said in JFK, once you're in the agency, always in the agency. Mm-hmm. And I think that's certainly the way it must be. And it's not just the CIA, but these journalists are co-opted, and they have, and so many of them. What's even sadder, as Harold Weisberg alluded to way back when, is that they don't need to be co-opted, because the way the colleges are, you talked about that a little bit earlier, but when you go to these, especially the universities, the Ivy Leagues, and the really good colleges, the colleges where almost no one but the 1% goes to, the ones that you don't need student loans for because they're coming from wealthy families to begin with, or they win scholarships they don't possibly need. They could go to more, financially strapped families. But the top colleges, at those institutions, the professors are all hopefully indoctrinated into this social justice warrior type of establishment liberal system, where the world is defined by these incredibly narrow parameters, and there's barely room for any public dialogue, but there's certainly no room for any so-called conspiracy theories, and anything outside of those very narrow parameters is by definition in their eyes a conspiracy theory. And they're trained as if, and they're not told to, I don't think, but it's as if they were Pavlovian dogs, and they were in a laboratory, and they were told over and over again, okay, when someone talks about the JFK assassination, 9/11, Sandy Hook, any of the Boston bombing, any of this stuff, immediately roll your eyes. Oh, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, or you're a tinfoil hat theorist, or, how many people would have had to have been involved? Someone would have talked. I mean, all the talking points you hear whenever I talk about all these subjects to a doubter, that's invariably what I get. How could so many people keep a secret and things like that? Well, lots of people did talk and have talked. I gave lots of examples in my book, too. And many of them are dead for talking or have had their lives ruined. So, but the public just, I really don't know what we can do beyond trying to wake up a few people at a time. And the process is slow. But I do think because the economy is – it's just going to keep getting worse unless drastic measures are taken, and it doesn't look like they're going to be. I think more and more young people are going to wake up, at least to some degree, because they're going to realize their birthrights have been stolen, and they're going to start questioning these things just on their own, because they're not going to trust any aspect of the system. And as we see already, the people that go to the internet for the news, they don't care. The reason the fake news mantra from Trump, it's probably his best legacy so far, is just having, they say fake, and it's ironic because they tried to throw that on Trump and the other other side. And he was rather, you know, I give it to him there. He was brilliant on that. He turned it right back on them. And so now it's CNN, it's fake news and all that. And I think that's a great thing, because at least the public now realizes, especially those young people, they just kind of, oh, yeah, I don't believe that stuff. Because it's not, they're not astute enough maybe to realize, well, they don't believe it because they've lied about everything from JFK to 9/11 and so forth. So why, that's what I've tried to point out. Why would you, you know, if you know a habitual liar in your own life that just lies about everything or exaggerates everything, you're not going to give them much credibility. So you're not going to, you're just going to be skeptical about anything they say. Well, I wish we would understand that's what the mainstream media in total is. They're like the biggest pathological liar you can imagine, and they have zero credibility. So I don't know why, until they can conclusively prove anything they say is true, I just assume that they're lying.
Yeah. And Operation Mockingbird, just that was a secret campaign that was created by the CIA in the late 1940s to allow the agency to influence the media. They were more or less continuing what they had established during the war. Of course, the CIA didn't exist during the war, but obviously the War Department and the Office of War Information and the OSS, the Psychological Warfare Agencies of the war, you know, the wartime administration, had pretty much taken over the media and even Hollywood. And so they were continuing this into the Cold War, which they brewed up. And it was, this was spearheaded by Frank Wisner. Frank Wisner hired Donald Graham, who controlled the Washington Post, and eventually hired Ben Bradley and these things.
Yeah.
And I was going through a list of – basically it was exposed in the 60s, but also in the 70s during the – I think it was the one of the church hearings or the maybe the Pike Committee hearings when the director went up there and said, you know, said we should talk about this in executive session and all that. But they admitted to controlling hundreds of top journalists and dozens of newspapers. These are the newspapers that control the news flow. But here's the list. One of the most important journalists under the control of Operation Mockingbird was Joseph Alsup, whose articles appeared in over 300 different newspapers. Other journalists, these names are like, you know, household names. Stuart Alsup. Ben Bradley, okay, this is the guy who championed the Pentagon Papers that we're hearing so much about now. Watergate, right? James Reston, C.D. Jackson, this was Time Magazine. Walter Pincus. Walter Pincus played a big role in destroying the career, I believe, of Gary Webb years later. Walter Winchell, everyone know, you know, people know him. Drew Pearson. Walter Lippmann. Walter Lippmann goes way back. He's the one that helped set up the Inquiry, which is sort of this prototypical CIA agency. Alan White, Edgar Ansel Morrow, Al Hendricks, all these big names. And, you know, William Paley, CBS. He was a psychological warfare agent during the war and all this stuff for CBS and these things. So it was pretty much all the names that we knew that defined how, you know, controlled how we understood what was going on in the world and how the world worked. They're all, you know, agents for the Central Intelligence Agency. And when we're talking about CIA, we're not just talking about, you know, you know, CIA proper, Langley. The CIA is an agency, and it acts in the interest of somebody. And that interest are the powers that be, the corporations, the banks, the finance, Wall Street, and the City of London, because these intelligence agencies developed out of the financial interests that grew out of big oil, the opium trade, and the handful of families that control these, that, you know, that established these cartels, and they became these more or less American royalty of these things. And they're able to leverage your wealth. The Rockefellers are a great example of this. Of course, the Rothschilds, everyone knows about the Rothschilds, supposedly. They leverage your wealth politically. They get control of the political process. They establish these agencies, alphabet soup agencies, and they go to work for them, more or less. And they control both sides of the debate, right and left. You know, that's why George Soros is so important with things like Black Lives Matter, because if the cops are getting a bunch of bad press for police brutality, they'll have Black Lives Matter go out and create a disturbance and create riots, and all the white people will then support the cops because they're afraid of blacks rioting.
You know,
this is how it's all controlled. And they patronize, they disperse their money to these organizations. Historically, we have examples in Europe like Operation Gladio, where the actually terrorist events were carried out. By these groups that were actually established by there's residual fascist elements from the war, but basically it was CIA and Western intelligence agencies would establish these paramilitary groups that would go out and they would carry out bombing attacks and blame the left for it, and for the purpose of changing the political environment, whether in Italy or in Belgium or in Germany and such. And people died, people were blown up in these things, and now we know that these things were false flag attacks. And, of course, we can, with that history, we can look at some of the more current events here, recent events here in the United States, and maybe get to look at them more skeptically, because they're used to manipulate the political environment. You know, these strange shooting events, whether it's Las Vegas or Sandy Hook, gotcha. And these things, you know.
Well, I mean, it's ever since the Gabby Giffords shooting, you know, and that was the first one that really opened my eyes, where I first started reading on the internet where these kids living in the parents' basements were putting on great YouTube videos and doing real, and that's where the real investigative reporting is being done. Mm-hmm. Those they're in the job that professional journalists don't do, and they started coming up with all these nuggets, and I thought, wow, this really does seem like it's a Truman Show sometimes. Certainly Sandy Hook, it really, and the Boston bombing, and all the way up through the Las Vegas shooting. There are just so many elements of all these big events that happen that are questionable, and you start looking at the witnesses and the behavior of the witnesses, and some claim that they've had the same witness at multiple events, and they're crisis actors and so forth. And, you know, you go down this rabbit hole, but I find it fascinating because, again, they're asking questions, and they're just bringing up to me. I try to just analyze it from the discrepancies in the stories that don't make any sense, and I don't really want to go too much into how the witness's behavior is, because you know you can always argue that. But if the story makes no sense and there are holes in it, that's what I try to question on, and that happens in every one of these events. And the media just goes nuts if you even try to. I mean, the Sandy Hook thing alone. I think they've got one of the fathers that is. That has sued Wolfgang Halbig and all these people several times. That is just, and I don't know any courtroom in the land where somebody like Halbig or any other independent researcher could win against that kind of pressure, because the jury system is going to be so prejudiced against him, because most people have been, you know, indoctrinated in this. Oh, this. He's bothering that poor man. He lost a child, and you know this terrible guy asking these questions. Well, you know. Wolfgang Halbig, one of the things he did, he went up to Newtown and tried to get into the local United Office United Way office there, just to look at some records. The police blocked it, barricaded it, and wouldn't let him in the United Way office. Now, what are they possibly hiding there? And that's the kind of thing that drives me crazy, is what are they hiding in all these instances? Why would something like that, that's a citizen researcher, and I presumably, let's say that was a New York Times reporter that was actually doing his job and trying to do that. Maybe the New York Times would protest if he was denied admittance to United Way office. I don't know. Maybe not. But we saw in Rolling Stone, so-called avant-garde cutting-edge magazine, when Michael Hastings died under very mysterious circumstances a few years back, after announcing he was, you know, going underground because, you know, basically he had this huge story, and then his car ran into the, you know, a tree at 200 miles an hour or some crazy nonsense that, you know, again, the story made no sense. Well, the Rolling Stone magazine, they did no investigation of it, and they and his widow, who, you know, they both basically really were disturbed by anybody asking any questions about it. And so I don't know what can happen if you
have – I found her interview strange.
Yes, very
strange. Was it Larry King who she on? She was all smiles?
Yeah, well, that's – you know, you find that in all these interviews. Why are all these grieving people so happy? And you can't help but wonder. But
Who she worked for. She worked for the administration. She was like this – government spokesman for the Pentagon and for the White House. Looking at her, she's very easy on the eyes.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, was she planted to like mislead Michael?
Yeah. And a lot of these witnesses are easy on the eyes, in some sense, something we've noticed too. You know, again, which would play the whole crisis actors thing, you know?
Yeah. And so, I mean, and she was just so oddly, I mean, she was very. She seemed very well adjusted, or very. I mean, she's no grieving, and about her. You know, she said she was lucky to have him for the short period, and she's nothing to complain about. Blah blah blah. You know.
Well, one. You know. We find that it goes. No, I think we go back to, you know, the Kennedy family. Their reaction is, their response has always been strange, other than John F. Kennedy Jr.'s, which, you know, in my hidden history, I did a huge investigation of that, and I pretty much demonstrated that that was his quest. Behind the scenes, he was obsessed with who killed his father, but the rest of them don't want any mention of it. And all these families to now, they just don't seem concerned with the facts around their loved one's death, other than the one family, ironically, that has been upfront about it. And I did an interview today. I was honored to be interviewed by Jesse Ventura today for his RT show about the Martin Luther King assassination. And the one family that I found in all of this that has really been asking the questions forever is his family. Mm-hmm. Coretta Scott King, Dexter King, Martin Luther King III, they all went and talked to Ray. They testified to try to get him a new hearing. They came out publicly and said they didn't think he did it. And they actually appeared to want to know what really happened. And I find that fascinating, because that's really an anomaly, because in all these other cases, whether they're high profile like the Kennedys or them, or just kind of unknown people that are caught up in tragedies that get publicized, like the Sandy Hook parents or Boston bombing or whatever, the attitude you always get from them, except for now, in 9/11, you do have some family members that were interested in the truth. 9/11 members for family members for truth and so forth. They don't get much of a say in the media, and you had that in Oklahoma City to some degree too. But the majority, they don't want to hear about it, and they get upset if you mention it. It's like I don't want to, and I don't know if my parents had been killed like that in some kind of a tragedy, and I knew I would be interested in the information, and when I started reading these things about, wait a minute, there's discrepancies here, there's some questions, I would want to know. I would want to know the truth. So I find that it doesn't ring true to me, the behavior
Yeah, you mentioned Oklahoma City, and you don't have to look at the wider issues or problems with that event, the bomb, and could a truck bomb done that, and who was Timothy McVeigh, and these things. But cases like Jesse Trentadue and his brother Kenneth.
Yes,
murdered in federal custody.
Yeah.
And obviously cover up there, trying to look like it was a suicide, and the body was all bruised. The real crude attempt to cover it up. But then the prisoner who witnessed his supposed murder also committed suicide. The story there is that Kenneth Trentadue had a striking resemblance to was it Guthrie or
John Doe number two, I think, wasn't it? Yeah. Or maybe it wasn't. It's like, because I think McVeigh was even talked about it behind closed doors. But Oklahoma City also featured another witness, and this is a perfect illustration of how the mainstream media works. Edie Smith, who was a kind of a celebrity in the media to begin with. They talked to her quite a bit because she's lost twin, I don't know if they were boys, I think they were twin boys, that were like two or three at the daycare centers. They showed videos, heart-wrenching videos of these kids, and here this poor woman lost twins. Now, her father, or stepfather, Glenn Wilburn, was an early citizen activist and died very young of cancer, not long after that, coincidentally or not, but he was one of the voices, independent voices early on questioning things. But Edie Smith early on was interviewed, and the first crack and that story, I guess, that opened the door for them to investigate it was CNN was interviewing her live when they were getting ready to demolish, cart away the remains of the Murrah building. And they thought she would be a trained parrot, I guess, and answer what she was supposed to. And they said, now do you feel with the rubble being carted away, do you feel they can move on and put this behind you? And she, unfortunately, she didn't give them the answer they wanted. Said, what I'm wondering is why, none of the family members of the kids belonging to the BATF parents, how come none of their kids were in the building that day? And they cut the interview off, and that was her last interview with the mainstream media. And so I think that's what happens. If you get someone who has been playing a role, not really even a willingly or not, but has been, interviewed and they've used her own personal tragedy for their ratings and show these heart-wrenching videos of these poor little kids that were killed. If they suddenly break form and do something like that where they question, they say something they're not supposed to say, well, then they're out of loop. They're not invited anymore. You're not invited to play in any more reindeer games after that. And that's what happened to her. And I think that would probably happen to almost anyone in that. And we saw that, you know, as far back as the JFK assassination, where, you know, Roger Craig, the only deputy sheriff that day, mm-hmm. that was seemingly doing his job. I mean, his career and his life unraveled. And I write a lot about it in Hidden History, but I mean, he ended up allegedly killing himself, whether he did or not. He was only 39 and his life ended, but he went through hell for a decade. You know, his car was bombed and his wife left him. And to this day, I think I'm friends with his nephew on Facebook, who's a strong defender of him, but his daughter just hates his memory and despises it and claimed he made everything up and stuff. And it's just unfortunate that these events, they spill over into families and people that do speak up. I guess, you know, at that point, you do sometimes say, well, okay, you can't really blame people for not speaking out, because look at the whistleblowers in prison, and look at someone like a Roger Craig who tried to do his job and spoke out against the only one really in law enforcement that was giving a contrary story, and he went from being officer of the year to you know, out of the loop completely.
Yeah, and that's similar to the fate of Terrence Yakey at Oklahoma City.
Yes, yeah. The same way.
Who started talking and then committed suicide. Apparently he cut his own throat or something and walked away from his car.
It was the world's most elaborate suicide. Yeah, I think he cut his throat, walked around. It was three or four different things together. I'm sorry I don't have the details right on my head.
Yeah, he shot himself in the head, like the top of his head.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, was to say it was overkill. I mean, it's you have to laugh at, you don't hate to laugh at something like that, but it was almost something out of a Monty Python skit, you know, where to be doing, you know, how many ways can I kill myself at once, you know, or something like that. But he was a law enforcement officer, wrote that letter about, you know, he's ashamed of what he was doing or whatever. And, you know, he knew what was going on. And that's these people are out there. There are people that question and that buck the system. And most of them, many of them at least, don't survive and to tell their story, or they go underground. And some of them I was unable to find when I was trying to. I wanted to try to find Edie Smith, for example. I wanted to talk to more of these people. But, you know, some of them are not really easy to find. And unfortunately, again, you know, none of this, if we just had. If the media just played its part with the JFK assassination, as I've said many times, I don't think RFK would have ever been assassinated if John F. Kennedy hadn't been. So I think if they had exposed what really happened to JFK, who knows how different the 60s would have been. I mean, even obviously we know if JFK hadn't have been assassinated, the 60s would have been entirely different. The Vietnam would have been – would not been what it was. And I don't think MLK or certainly not RFK – would have been assassinated, but just was just one of these things. And even now, like I said, something like the Seth Rich murder, something like that far down the road, if the layers were peeled back and the truth fully exposed so that it was undeniable, which to many of us it is, but it was undeniable to the public at large, everything begins to crumble, because the power that the leaders have over us is that the majority of us still or give them validation and are still basically, as you know, as I say, I wrote another blog article recently. There's a, you know, I believe there's a cumulative official narrative, you know, people that either accept official narratives or not, but there's one gigantic official narrative, and it's basically, it's like a national referendum. Are you giving a thumbs up to the way things are going or a thumbs down? The people that are giving thumbs up to the way things are going, they're empowering this corruption, because mm-hmm. you have to take it to task. When Trump talked about draining the swamp, it excited a lot of us. I mean, obviously he's not doing that, but if the swamp was drained, I mean, any even symbolic gestures like the Hillary Clintons of the world or something going to prison, or Bill Clinton or whatever – even symbolic gestures like that show the public, okay, that nobody's above the law, when we know they are, but the only reason they're above the law is because the justice system is so corrupt, just like the rest of it. But if things like that happen, it would invigorate the public, trust would come back, and it would. I mean, I think there's honest people in all leadership all across the board, but the problem is they're so outnumbered. But this would empower them to feel, okay, you know, I can stand up too. And if all this, like Robert Kennedy, one of his great statements, you know, every time we send forth we stand up against injustice or something, we send forth a tiny ripple of hope. And those tiny ripples can gather together, eventually make a tidal wave that can overcome the mightiest depression. And I think I like to try to remember that all the time. And I whatever little I can do, I try to send forth tiny ripples of hope just talking about this kind of stuff. And you're doing it as well on your show. And I think if more people did that, eventually it would be a groundswell. But I think it would start. All it would need is a few investigative reporters here and there in the mainstream media. If they really start, a few courageous real editors, a few courageous network presidents, which we don't appear to have any of those right now. But I mean, you know, look what happened with Oliver Stone's JFK. I mean, the fact that movie was made is still amazing to me, because I've got one of the most amazing books that came out of that was JFK, The Book of the Film, which was written by him and Zachary Sklar. If anybody reads that, you can see, and all it is all the mostly attack pieces that were written against Oliver Stone just for making that movie. And it's a thick book. It's amazing. I mean, Dan Rather editorialized three different times on CBS Nightly News against Oliver Stone and his movie. Unprecedented. Never happened before.
Well, he was part of the cover-up.
Exactly. He had a personal interest in it. I mean, his fame was made out there lying as a local reporter.
And years later, he's reporting on JFK Jr.'s death. Misrepresenting the weather and things like that. I remember...
Exactly. They all did. And it just... So it's, you know, we... I tend to remember people like, you know, Dan Rather. I always, because I know, you know, how he got his start. So when people would talk about anything else like that, I used to judge people exclusively like that on the JFK assassination. Well, he's lying about that. I hate him, you know, same way with like a guy like Tom Hanks. Now I can't watch a Tom Hanks movie anymore, because I know he's a vocal lone nutter, you know, that wanted to make a miniseries about Vincent Bugliosi's book. So I can't watch his movies anymore. James Franco, same way. James Franco wrote a ridiculous op-ed in the paper defending the Warren Report a while back. It's like, I know these are airhead celebrities, but they can't.
Why? It's funny. It shows you the importance of celebrity.
Yeah.
Promoting the official story or the system itself. That's the whole reason why celebrities are created in the first place. To rope people into the system, because most people now identify with celebrities, the celebrity culture. And of course, Hollywood was long ago weaponized. James Franco. You're going to listen to James Franco?
It's laughable, but when I read that, I said, what? I mean, why would he even bother to do that? But that's you're right. The power of celebrity, and it just shows. You know, Richard Belzer a long time ago made a joking comment, and I think there's a lot of truth in it when he said, you know, 90% of the public believes there is a conspiracy to kill JFK, and the other 10% work for the government or the media.
Yeah.
And I think you can extend that media to Hollywood, because that's why Oliver Stone just remains to me such a profiling courage, because he to make the movie he made like that, and you saw what an impact that had. I mean, Oprah had him on there. You know, Oprah wouldn't be talking about the JFK assassination ever, but he was big enough that she had to. The movie was big enough, it had to be talked about. So he was on all the shows, and he stood strong, and I become friends with his son John Stone, and you know, there's a culture there where they're, you know, they know what's going on. He still in this movie Snowden last year showed that. So so there's hope with people like that. I mean, he you know, he lived. I mean, they tried to destroy his career, but he still thrives. And so I think you can, you know, you can make statements, you can make stands like that. And I just wish more people would. And that movie gave me hope that maybe things were changing. We haven't seen, you know, too many more like that. But maybe they'll, you know, eventually be an Oliver Stone of network television or something that'll stand up and make something, you know.
It did. I think it created the political momentum for their records review board, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That came out of that. And it just because the assassination at that point was, you know, it had waves of interest, obviously, in the mid to late 60s leading up to the Garrison investigation was the first wave. And then the mid 70s, when I first started looking into it, that led to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, that was the second big wave. And then David Lifton wrote Best Evidence in 1980 or so. It was a bestseller, and that created a wave of interest for a while. And then Oliver Stone in 1991, JFK. So, and that's really the last big wave, I think, that, you know, unfortunately, that has, you know.
And two important points one of the House Select Committee on the assassinations concluded that the murders of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, and I believe Martin Luther King were probably a result of a conspiracy, not a lone nut. So the last official word is probably a conspiracy, but they didn't recommend a reinvestigation, interestingly enough.
No, well, that's it. And that's, well, actually, they didn't look into the RFK thing. It was JFK and MLK. And they did, but they did say it was probably the result of a conspiracy. And but yeah, you said they're the matter rested, and it was they left the door open for the Justice Department. Of course, the Justice Department.
And of course, it was during those hearings, roughly 1976 through 78. You had another string of murders, you know, like Giancana and. What's his name?
George DeMorin Shield.
George DeMorin Shield. I think also was a
Johnny Roselli.
Johnny Roselli was found floating, cut up, floating in Miami Bay.
Yeah.
Was that guy Lovelace or Lovelady had a heart attack or something too?
Lovelady. He probably died around that area. Billy Lovelady. Yeah. But I don't know if he would have been questioned or not. But yeah, they were dropping like flies, and it was very similar like what happened when Garrison started his investigation. I mean, his witnesses died like flies, and the ones that weren't dying refused extradition orders. I mean, unprecedented. Governors Ronald Reagan in California. Yeah.
Yeah, Reagan would not. Wouldn't cooperate. And
Reagan wouldn't extradite witnesses, and neither would Governor Connolly, of all people, who was in the limousine of Texas. So I mean, Garrison?
It's not been established that his investigation was CIA and FBI. They were all messing up his investigation. Wrenches into the world, which is illegal. I mean, this is a district attorney.
Sure,
because
Victor Marchetti would later write. You know, he was a high ranking official, and he turned later and wrote the CIA and the Cult of Intelligence, I believe, a bestseller. He admitted in that book, he talked about attending meetings with Richard Helms, who, by the way, was Ben Bradley's childhood buddy, best friend of childhood. Richard Helms was
– And former journalist.
Exactly. Richard Helms also would have lunch regularly with a so-called radical anti-war senator, Eugene McCarthy, who worked with a lot of ex-CIA people to undermine RFK's campaign before they assassinated him. I wrote that about in the book, but I got off track there. I'm sorry. What was I even talking about before that? I got sidetracked
agency disrupting the Garrison investigation.
And so it was clearly, there's no question about. And Marchetti had wrote in his book about how Richard Helms would talk at meetings, top secret meetings, about, are we giving Clay Shaw all the help he needs down there?
Yeah.
So we knew about it. And that came out, I think that probably came out about the time of it was a great period for investigative work by the Congress. You had a strong Congress there briefly in the post-Watergate period by real liberal Democrats like Frank Church, who I think was a good man, and Pike in the House. A lot of good stuff came out. I believe it came out in that time, because that's when I first was, I was just coming of age, and I really became a radical leftist because of that, and I thought, boy, this is I want to be one of these guys. And then it was just so terrible, this terribly disillusioning to see all that fall away, and then with the election of Reagan, the country turned in an entirely different direction, and now we have a fake left and a fake right, and it's just we're caught in between, because we have the social justice warriors on the left that are all pro war, and they're pro everything wrong, and on the right we have the Ayn Rand disciples, the Paul Ryan types that want to basically want people dying in the streets and want the law of the jungle to prevail, and all they care about is how much profit they can make for the CEOs.
Mm-hmm. And you have the another goodie that came out of the traced back to the JFK, the movie, because the Records Review Board was created by law, which ironically I think was signed by George H.W. Bush, but implemented by Bill Clinton in the 90s. Around 1999 or 2000, the Operation Northwoods was revealed as part of the release, which is a documented false flag proposal.
Yeah. How about that? Now imagine those of us that make fun of people that question Sandy Hook or any of the Boston bombing, that these are orchestrated events. Well, that's exactly what Operation Northwoods was. They were talking about faking plane crashes and deaths. I don't know how many real deaths they were proposing. I don't doubt they would do it. But the whole thing was an orchestrated thing. We were going to try to fake all these catastrophes and blame them on Cuba, mm-hmm. which is exactly what we see happening with what a lot of us think are fake events to this day that are usually I think they're more psychological warfare, but on the surface, most of them appear to be just kind of overt attempts to restrict gun rights. I mean, yeah. At the very least. But I think it's much more deeper psychologically than that. And so that's when I start going down the rabbit holes. And I have to steer myself away because it's like,
yep,
wow. Yep. I don't want to do too much investigation of it because it really, you know, it's like, whoa. That's kind of my own – what's left of my normalcy bias kick. In there, I think.
Well, this interesting quote. I don't. You know, this could be apocryphal because I could never find a proper source for it, but I think it's true nonetheless. It's apparently said by John Swinton back in the 19th century.
Yeah. Yes.
And again, maybe made up, but either way, I think it's true. He goes, "There's no such thing at this date of the world's history in America as an independent press. You know it, and I know it." There is not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. I am paid weekly for keeping my honest opinion out of the paper, and I'm connected with. Others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. If I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of journalists is the business of journalists is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it, and I know it, and what folly is this toasting an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings, and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. So whether he said it or made up, either way, I think it's true. So
if he made it up, it's a pretty accurate fantasy, at least the way the media is today, isn't it?
Yeah. So
yeah, it's unreal. I couldn't think any less of the media if I tried. And you know, it's ironic because that's when, I was a teenager when Watergate happened, and that's when I first started paying attention to politics. And I was a fiery, anti-Nixon left-wing Democrat. You know, I thought the Democrats were the good guys, and I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be like Woodward and Bernstein. And it wasn't until a couple years later when I started reading about the JFK assassination that I started realizing, wait a minute, I was working for Mark Lane's as a volunteer for his Citizens Committee of Inquiry in my area. I was a local chapter of my group out here. And, we tried to lobby Congress and call television stations and newspapers. And it was just really rude awakening because I was a naive teenager. And I thought that, these terrible Nixonian type, Republicans were holding everything back, and if just the liberal Democrats could get in there, boy, they would expose the truth about the Kennedy assassination too. And I just, as I went on, I discovered, wow, the liberals are actually, more pro Warren Commission lies than the conservatives are in a lot of cases. So it really changed the way I looked at things. And obviously I didn't become a professional journalist, or I doubt very seriously I would have been writing books like this if I had been. I don't know what I would have been written. I guess, who knows? I might have had bigger publishers, but, maybe more exposure in the mainstream media. But, that's what I wanted to do because I thought, I still like watching old movies with the old real journalist pecking away at the typewriter with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth and hat, kind of hat cockeyed on him, and a bottle of bourbon next to him, going after the big guys, writing the stories no matter what, going after the big headlines. And it's just, if those kind of journalists ever existed to any degree, I think they're limited, they just go up against really powerful forces. And obviously they don't exist today because they're just completely anemic and powerless. And, the only investigation that you might see once in a while, a local news station will maybe investigate a used car dealership or something, go undercover or something like that. But to go after the big boys, they just won't do it. And it's a shame because if they showed some backbone, again, that sunshine is the greatest disinfectant. And if you shine the light on these people, they're like rats and they'd scurry to the corners, and it would it would flush them out, it would expose them, and their reign of terror would be over. And I think we'd finally be able to throw this tyranny off, and even the people that are asleep would realize, wow, things are running a lot better now. You know, why is it? Yeah, because we finally have honest leadership out there and people that aren't constantly conspiring and trying to subvert things for their own personal gains or weird agendas that we can't even hope to understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, look at me. I used to love Ronald Reagan. I thought just if the Republicans got control of Congress and they balanced the budget and, mm-hmm. you know, in these things And here we are. You know, I was a right wing Reaganite in the '80s, and you were a left winger, McGovernite exactly. in the '70s, and here we are in 2018 agreeing. So
Well, by the time Reagan came around, I had already started reading very far right wing material like Gary Allen's Non-Dairy Cow Conspiracy.
Yes,
So I was familiar with. I mean, I was familiar with the far right too, and I was overlapping from far left to far right. But I knew Reagan's background. I saw who he was appointing to his cabinet, and so forth, as much as we saw with Trump. But what got me early on is how he didn't even cut. He could have cut the Department of Energy and Education very mm-hmm. easily. They'd just been created. He didn't even do that.
Nope.
He cut nothing. He only raised taxes on everyone except the 1% because he raised Social Security mm-hmm. taxes, and he started taxing Social Security. And I kept saying, "Wait!" And I tried to talk to the blue collar workers I was working with then, and they were saying, "Yeah, keep on cutting those taxes." And I said, "Have you looked at your paychecks? What are you taking home more money?" And they just couldn't get that. And I'd say, "You realize he's now taxing your Social Security?" But we were all too young to realize what that meant then. I mean, you're talk about a double tax and the irony. They must laugh behind closed doors at the gullibility of the people, because here, this great anti-government, anti-tax slasher, this tax slashing guy came up with a way. I mean, and I'm attributing it to Reagan. He's obviously a figurehead. I don't think he knew what's going on. But under his administration, they came up away with a tax Social Security benefits, which you've already been taxed on. So, once these things get ingrained, is anybody talking about that? Any conservatives talking about rolling that back? Why should Social Security taxes be taxed, but benefits be taxed? But it's really criminal what's going on. And there, as you mentioned, with my far left and your far right, there really isn't any hope anywhere, because the real honest guy, I think Ron Paul probably would have been an honest far right mm-hmm. guy. And I think Dennis Kucinich, Cynthia McKinney type would be an honest far left. But as we see with Trump, once we saw.
But they're crazy. You see,
they don't give them a chance. Like, we were talking recently about Oprah running for president, and I was talking to John Barber the other day. He wanted me to call into his radio show, and I told him, I said, he was asking about Oprah, and I said, well, there's a great black woman out there. If you want to have a black woman president, Cynthia McKinney, I voted for her once in 2008. She's one of the best candidates I can think of out there. But, everybody, and she could debate circles around Oprah, but it's not going to be allowed to happen. Instead, and I said, imagine the irony of the people that are laughing at the billionaire celebrity we have as president now. So what's their alternative? They come up with another billionaire celebrity, Oprah Winfrey. So let's have the battle of the billionaires, the celebrities to run for president. And neither one of them obviously have any qualifications. I mean, it's ridiculous. But that's what we've come to now. I guess it was bad enough when we had these kind of tried and true politicians. But, when you start talking about people like Oprah and The Rock and,
The Rock.
The Rock. I mean, they talked about him running for president. It's like, you've got to be kidding here.
It's like this is President Camacho in Idiocracy. Remember the
yes. Well, the it's, I think it, The Rock would fit, because Trump in many ways reminds me of President Camacho. Yeah. Sometimes the way he runs things. I mean, he's got a lot of that personality. But I think the Idiocracy is here. The only thing the Idiocracy didn't acknowledge, it was a great movie. Mike Judge made a great movie. Everybody should watch it. But he didn't acknowledge – he got the corruption part – I mean the incompetence part and the Idiocracy part right, but he didn't acknowledge the puppet masters at the top, the manipulation that goes on, because there's obviously the corruption there. And when you get that stupid, I don't think the people at the top are ever going to become that stupid. They're just manipulating the stuff. But it's what I've always called – it's just a deadly cocktail of corruption and incompetence that we're mired under. And it's hard to – I don't know.
And – the mass ignorance or stupidity isn't so much a problem of dysgenics. I think it's psychological warfare, dumbing down, intentional dumbing down, educational system, popular culture, weaponized culture. And of course, that's been, you know, researched and documented. That
One of the most memorable scenes in 1984. If people have probably read that, Orwell just described it beautifully, where he talked about when Winston Smith goes running through the proles are the vast majority, and the proles are representing the 80% of the people now that aren't in power. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're all basically the proles to one degree or another, and the proles, unlike us, they had relative freedom as long as because they were so dumbed down, they knew they would never question anything, so they let them, you know, drink and do whatever they wanted, but within those very narrow parameters. But he ventured into the inner party members weren't even supposed to go in the proletariat's parts of town. He went over there and he got excited because he saw them, you know, showing more motion and fire and than anybody in the inner party ever did. But then he realized every time that they were arguing about the lottery. This is back in the 1940s. The lottery or sport.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so much about that book was, most people have read it, but and it's one of the most hilarious inside jokes of all time, that 1984, I think, is still taught in public schools as required reading for high school students. It was back in my day, and I think it still is. But the idea that this book, this incredibly wonderful prophetic book, that predicted this dystopian world in so many ways. I mean, so many terms like the thought police, mm-hmm. Big Brother, a memory hole, all these things come from 1984, Orwell's fantastic, brilliant mind.
But televisions that spy on us?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's so much of it there that's – and the idea that it's being taught in schools and – is those malleable minds and those teachers that teach it, they're not getting it. Wow, wait a minute. This is our reality now. I mean, it's taught as a warning of what might happen if we don't watch out. It's like, yeah, boy, imagine having these things happen. But unfortunately, we've gone even beyond 1984 in many instances. And it's so sad when you read, because I remember reading it so many times when I was a young man, and reading it even as I got older. I just, each time I read it, I said, wow, I appreciated it more. But I thought, man, this is incredible how much of this has come true. And no one admits it. And you try to talk to people about it, and they kind of nod, but it's just amazing. And Americans have become so dumb. I talked on social media today about, you know, the tipping point as far as police or anything else. And I have to agree with the people that say, I really don't know if there would ever be a tipping point at this time for Americans, because they've been bent over in a position for so many decades. It's almost like they're incapable of getting up at this point. And it's this, you know, they've taken it for so long that they don't know any other way. And to try to throw off their masters, I just don't know if they could ever do it. And it's sad that we would have to wait for something as awful as a huge economic collapse to maybe hope something better comes out of it. But that may be our only hope.
Yeah, because good times aren't going to breed hard good men. It's they've become soft and corrupt. And that's one of those things, because you don't want to anticipate or human suffering and what can come from that. But nevertheless, it's hard to, when people are contented or comfortable, they're not going to stir and not going to do anything. And, you know,
right.
They don't see themselves. They don't see, you know, as long as there's beer in the refrigerator, and there's pizza to eat and the sports to watch.
No. Yeah, that's it. I think for the men, the sports is important, and for the women, I guess having the shopping malls, I'm not sure what they would need. But I think for the young people, what would really have an impact would be if the cell towers went down, because they're walking around absorbing themselves. I literally think they'd just sit down in the middle of the street and just collapse. I mean, it's like someone unplug them. I think, you know.
Yeah, I was driving around a few weeks ago, and a bus, school bus. Discharged its passengers, you know, the students, and they look like they're like middle school kids, 13, 14 maybe, and these kids dispersed, and they all immediately got on their cell phones. None of them, what I saw, none of them talking to each other, mm-hmm. and as they got on their cell phones, they dispersed into the middle of the street, not looking at the traffic or anything.
No. Yep. They're like untrained toddlers. I say to myself, it's amazing. They really do wander blindly out into traffic, and you have to think, well, these really are like toddlers that have not been taught to look both ways, and it's just amazing. I don't know how you overcome that. I said otherwise, I think again, they're probably the group that's going to be in for the rudest awakening of all, because they live in that matrix world on their cell phones, and if the cell towers go down, they're just going to be, tapping on the blank screen, and I don't know when they're going to look up and like, wow, wait a minute, what's, I'm outside the matrix now or whatever. It's like, what do I do? And it's the world we create, and it's something that's wonderful technology, but unfortunately, I think it's gone the other direction with the young people, where it's created such a different world within itself that they've become kind of and it's immune to reality. And I think that's maybe another reason why it's harder sometimes to talk to very young people, especially about what's going on, because that's what I found about talking to history to people, is that, young people especially don't know the fake history. They don't, they don't even know anything about the event. So if you try to say that, Oswald didn't kill JFK, then, they might not know who Oswald is. They don't even know the lies. So to try to tell them what the truth is, it gets lost, because you have to be able to deconstruct the official story first. And if you have to teach them the official version first, then it kind of loses. It doesn't have quite the same impact. But
listen, I want to thank you for coming on.
My pleasure.
How can people follow your work? What's the best way?
Well, I write regularly on my blog. It's Keeping It Unreal, named after my novel, The Unreals. And it's donaldjeffries.wordpress.com. And I'm easy to find. You can Google, Survival of the Richest, Hidden History, certainly. And you can find lots of information. The books are on Amazon. They're in Barnes & Noble stores and everywhere, Skyhorse Publishing. And I don't post quite as much. I don't really post much at all anymore in the JFK forums, but I am active on social media. I write a lot there, and I tweet some, not probably, but I do a blog fairly regularly, so people can keep up with me there. And hopefully Hidden History will be out sometime down the road, and we'll be able to talk more about that.
Great. Yeah, when that comes out, maybe we'll talk about that. And
sure.
Go from there. Listen, I want to, thank you. Wish you a good night, and we'll be in touch. And
sure.
I'll be posting this probably tomorrow. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Sounds great. I appreciate that, and I always have enjoy talking to you anytime.
Yeah, great. Enjoy the talk. Good night.
Thanks. Thanks, Tim.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye.
I look high. I look low. I look in everywhere I go. Looking for a home in the heart of the country. I'm gonna move, I'm gonna go, I'm gonna tell everyone I know. Looking for a home in the heart of the country. Heart of the country where the holy paper grows. Heart of the country, smell the grass in the meadow. One horse, one sheep, I won't get me good night's sleep. Living in a home in the heart of the country. I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going to tell everyone I know. Living in a home in the heart of the country. Heart of the country where the holy people grow. Heart of the country, smell the grass in the meadow. Oh,